From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. A Bride for the Devil by Stuart Palmer. Just as a curiosity, insisted Dr. Baynard, I assure you that it is a very great bargain, even at the price. Perhaps, murmured Emily Parkinson slowly. Her crimson-tipped fingers stroked the yellowed sheet of parchment. But the price does seem exorbitant, just for some faded old lettering that I can't even read. I have every reason to believe, the doctor continued, that it is made of real human skin. How simply terrible! Dr. Baynard knew that Mrs. Parkinson was going to buy it. And she knew it also. This hesitation and haggling was a little game that she liked to play before squandering her husband's money on antiques or colored glass or primitive paintings. She was a handsome, Juanesque person with smooth, suspiciously yellow hair, fine teeth, and the general appearance of a woman 10 years her junior. Her record of 3 husbands and 2 divorces indicated that she was, at the very least, somewhere in her 40s. But expensive beauty treatments had kept her plump face smooth as a girl's. Her warm, enfolding smile, her full breast, her ample femininity, had since her school days held out a promise unfulfilled to her husband's, or for that matter to anyone else. Her current spouse, Frederick Parkinson, kept himself nowadays almost entirely to his Wall Street office, his club, and to a succession of pretty little secretaries, models, and chorus girls, from whom, according to rumor, he received whatever warmth and happiness can be purchased for spot cash. He was represented in Emily Parkinson's life mainly by the large checkbook which now lay before her on the Sheraton desk in the big, heavily draped library of the Park Avenue apartment. I assure you, dear lady, Dr. Baynard was saying, that this is in all ways a most unusual sheet of parchment. Any collector of curiosa. But what is so curious about a page torn from a volume written only 300 years ago? It's handwritten, too. And most books were set in type by then, weren't they? Dr. Baynard, steadying himself by gripping the edge of the desk, bowed creakily. This page, he explained, comes from the notorious Augsburton de Mendeschwanz of Benedict Koenig, a factual account of the torments of the Inquisition in early Germany. A very grim, almost sadistic work, although supposedly set down for the glory of God and the edification of the public, in very primitive black letter German. However, it is well known among students that manuscript paper or parchment was very scarce at certain periods, particularly in the monasteries of Germany and France. The good monks were forced to make inroads out of pious zeal upon their own libraries. They carefully bleached out the previous older writings in order to provide blank space for their own composition. It was thus, we are told, that almost all of the poems of Sappho were lost. Mrs. Parkinson toyed with her fountain pen. Yes, doctor? That is what evidently happened in this case. The writer ran short of paper and used a parchment, a most unusually fine and soft parchment, for the last page of the 16th chapter of his manuscript. It is interesting, of course, to conjecture as to the ancient volume from which the sheet was taken, and how such a thing happened to be in a monastery at all. However, I digress. The point is that the advances of modern science, particularly in chemistry and in fluoroscopic and infrared lighting, can bring back the ancient writings even though they are, as in this case, invisible to the naked eye. Here Dr. Baynard smiled, showing all his yellowed bridge work. The original volume was sent to a colleague of mine for appraisal. In assisting him, I chanced to notice the unusual texture of this page and took the liberty of removing it. Under the magic lights, dear lady, there appeared words and then complete sentences set down in a crabbed Latin hand. It must date back another 600 or 700 years. At the least, I happen to have with me a literal translation of the first few paragraphs. Read, dear lady, for yourself. He offered a typewritten sheet, which Mrs. Parkinson accepted with a gracious bow. She opened the gold case, removed her pince-nez, and began to read. After a moment, her mouth began to drop open, and her naturally hyperthyroid eyes bulged even more. "Good heavens," she cried. When she had finished, there was a marked flush on her face and cheek. "It's very specific, isn't it?" After a moment, she put down the sheet and reached for the checkbook. "I really shouldn't," she said, "but I'll make it a birthday present to myself, ahead of time." Dr. Baynard looked extremely pleased, a smile showing faintly through his wispy Van Dyke. "I am very gratified, dear lady, and not only because of the slight commission involved. It is naturally not at all the sort of thing which could be offered to the regular dealers in the usual way. But one must be broad-minded, mustn't one?" Mrs. Parkinson blotted the check carefully. "I think it is perfectly fascinating. You will, of course, continue with a translation for me." "It will be a pleasure, madam. Because the most wonderful idea has just come to me." Dr. Baynard, holding up the check lovingly before tucking it away in his thin leather billfold, suddenly caught his breath. "My dear lady, you're not thinking of trying it?" She nodded brightly. "Just as an adventure, of course. After all, the thing is really a ritual, is it not? Combined with a very clear and detailed recipe." "But some of the ingredients?" "Yes, of course, doctor. The corpse fat and the unicorn's horn and the blood of stillborn babes. We may not be able to get everything, but one can make substitutions. After all, the medical profession used to laugh at the Chinese herb doctors who prescribed the ground-up heads of toads for heart trouble, until it was discovered that digitalis was contained in them. What should we aim at is the spirit, if not the letter, of the list of ingredients. You will help me, doctor?" Dr. Baynard had had 2 glasses of excellent sherry, and Mrs. Parkinson's eyes were very large and warm and compelling. "Why, I could hardly refuse, dear lady. One cannot be, however, too hopeful about any possible results." "Naturally. But we must not forget that where there is so much smoke, there might be fire. After all, at some of the seances last year, I very definitely felt something. There are more things in heaven and earth, you know. Besides, it is really a scientific experiment. Out of this beginning was born the Satanist Society, with Emily Parkinson as its president and prime mover, Dr. Baynard as secretary and master of ceremonies. Mrs. Parkinson felt very daring, devilish even, as she explained to her little group of kindred spirits the adventure that lay before them. There were a dozen or so, almost all wealthy, idle women, who had long since passed over to others the care of their homes, their husbands, and their children. Not that many of them had ever cared to risk the travail and responsibility of having children in the first place. Some of the ladies had been with Mrs. Parkinson through her Vedanta area, through Dr. Kue, the Oxford movement, yoga, Christian Science, and a few of the most daring had even followed her into a brief and unsatisfying series of black masses under the guidance of a defrocked Roman Catholic priest. They had sat through endless seances led by a succession of mediums, including the famous Marjorie of Boston. They had heard horns blown, tambourines pounded, and had felt the wet touch of ectoplasm, or wet cheesecloth, in the darkness. They had tried numerology, during which many of them changed the spelling of their first names. They had for a time trusted themselves to the guidance of the stars, with individual horoscopes prepared by the best and most expensive astrologers, and had shivered with delicious apprehension when their sign was in the wrong house or under a baleful influence. But there had never been anything like this. The ladies of the group lived in a veritable frenzy of excitement during the weeks, and there were many, many weeks, while Dr. Baynard was translating the rest of the invocation and painstakingly assembling the necessary ingredients. "Let us take as our slogan that nothing is impossible," Mrs. Parkinson had said. It was surprising, really, how much could be done with the lavish backing of the Parkinson checkbook. Of course, there were a number of substitutions that had to be made, for the original manuscript had been couched in the most archaic and almost fantastic language that could be imagined. It was Dr. Baynard who secured powdered unicorn's horn by bribing a zoo attendant to supply him with a bit of a rhinoceros tusk. For what was the fabled beast but the result of garbled tales brought back to Europe from Africa by someone who had met someone who had seen a rhino? Grave robbing was avoided by the simple mean of making an arrangement with the service staff of a large hospital where stillborn babies were nothing out of the way. And as for the venom of an adder, Dr. Baynard discovered that cobra venom was available in small quantities at most medical supply houses. So it was that slowly, one by one, the long list of necessities was at least completed, in the spirit if not completely in the letter of the formula. It was Mrs. Parkinson who insisted upon waiting until St. John's Eve for the actual ceremony. There might be nothing to the ancient tradition, but again there might. What is most important is to place ourselves as much as possible in tune, in harmony with the forces that we hope to evoke. The day it finally arrived and the ladies gathered at Mrs. Parkinson's big white country house on the north shore of Long Island. The hour had first been set at midnight, but after some research by the doctor, it had been changed to moonrise, which was due to occur shortly after 8 in the evening. It was a full round moon that hung over the sound like a worn copper coin. For some time, the big house had been closed, which made it all the better. Mrs. Parkinson wanted no servants around to gossip and pry. With the help of the doctor, who was fairly trembling at the weight of his responsibility, the unused ballroom was made ready. There were folding chairs to be set up, lighting to be arranged, and the skylight opened so that the moonlight could enter. There was a twitter of delighted apprehension among the ladies as they saw the stage, which had originally been the musician's stand. It was bare now, covered only with a dark carpet on which had been traced in various colored chalks a five-sided figure with beautifully drawn devices in its corners. This pentacle was illuminated only by one shaded bowl from the side, but a deeper, eerie light was beginning to shine from the brim of an iron pot which hung from a tripod set within the pentacle, and into which Dr. Baynard was from time to time throwing bits of unmentionable material, or pouring little gouts of liquid from an assortment of bottles, all the while referring constantly to a list in his hand. Mrs. Parkinson stood beside him on the platform, as was her right. She was, the other ladies had to admit, looking her very best in an evening gown of black and crimson, which made the most of her fine shoulders and bust. "Please sit down, lady," she announced. "In a very few minutes the time will be ripe. I must ask that we all maintain the most rigorous silence during this experiment. We must concentrate and hold the thought." She glared at one of the guests in the back row. "There will be no smoking, please." The ladies settled themselves with a hushing, whispering buzz and rustle, and then all was silence. Mrs. Parkinson watched, nodding her approval as Dr. Baynard tossed in a few more herbs and potions, and the pot flared higher. She then backed away to where a big radio phonograph stood and touched the switch. In a moment, the room was filled with the powerful, though diminished, music of the Danse Macabre. The house lights were completely dark now, and in that darkness, the lady sat still and held the thought. It is true that no two of them held the same thought, for the conception of his satanic majesty were all very different, based upon folklore, dimly remembered religious education and literature. One lady in the front row, who had once been an avid reader of James Branch Cabell, visioned the adversary as a neat, respectable tradesman in a brown velveteen jacket. Her neighbor, more in the classical tradition, saw him as Lucifer, son of the morning, a beautiful, proud, fallen angel, a little like Rudolph Valentino, only with more character in his face. To some of the others, he was Mephistopheles, the swaggering Gallic devil with wax mustache and a pointed beard, wily yet polite, with a contract ready for signature and a promise of all the riches of this world. Yet again, there were ladies in the audience who confused him with Pan, thinking of the cloven hoof, the shaggy dancing goat legs, the classic profile in the pipe of reeds that blew such strange, sweet, overpowering tunes. Oddly enough, each one of them had retained an idea of the Prince of Darkness, out of the illustrations seen in childhood, out of folklore and literature, when all the other concepts of religion had been long since eaten away. The villain of the piece is easier to remember when the curtain has fallen. Who was it who trapped Fagin, who battled with Quasimodo, who sought to drive the stake through Dracula? Not that anyone was going to let herself be disappointed when nothing happened. The experiment was, of course, doomed to failure. But even in its failure, it would prove something, and it was all terribly, terribly thrilling. Sober and unsmiling, his manner somehow reverent, Dr. Baynard tossed another handful of ingredients into the pot, and then he began to read aloud from the paper he held in his hand. Belphegor, Asmodeus, Beelzebub. The list of names was very long indeed, and the doctor's voice was thin and weak. One of the ladies began to titter in pure nervousness, and Mrs. Parkinson glared, with her finger to her lips, until there was a silence again. Now the incense was pouring out of the brazier, a pillar of thick, brownish smoke, streaked with flashes of reddish fire. Aishma Devi, cried Dr. Baynard, still following his text. Azazel, Asitophel, Zeta, Ishtar, Arkad, princes, principalities, powers, thrones, and dominions. Here he tossed a handful of whitish powder into the fire, which immediately erupted with a blaze of greenish-yellow flame. Dr. Baynard cleared his throat and began, Amen forever, glory the power, the is thine, for...
It's backwards, explained the lady in the audience to her next neighbor.
Forgive, and bread daily, our day this us give. His voice was fading. Mrs. Parkinson peered at him, wondering if they really ought to go any further. Something had gone wrong with the record, too, for it was going round and round in the same groove.
Doctor, are you all right? She whispered.
Heaven is it as even earth on will be done thy, come kingdom thy, name thy be hallowed. The doctor was speaking faster and faster now. Heaven and art who father our. Then there was a long and agonizing pause, during which the only sound in the room was Dr. Baynard's labored breathing and the monotonous repetition of the record. Mrs. Parkinson shut it off and turned to the audience. Her poise had never deserted her, and she was quite evidently prepared for even such an anticlimax as this.
Lady, she cried, I'm sure that we all, I myself felt something there at the end, a very definite something in the room.
Her voice died away in her throat as she saw the faces of the ladies in the audience, the bloated terror masks that yammered and goggled up at her. She turned to see Dr. Baynard kneeling within the pentacle. Then she looked behind her. She shrieked with all the power of her lungs, Retro nas Satanas! What happened after that is to some extent a matter for conjecture, as the accounts of eyewitness differ. Each of the ladies in the panic-stricken audience carried away with her on her mad flight a vision of a squat, anthropomorphic entity which had taken shape on the platform. It stood there for a moment,
surprised and blinking, crouched on its thick, bowed legs. Its body was toad-like, scabrous and oily with a glistening, dripping ichor, and the scent which pervaded the room was by no means the comparatively clean reek of sulfur and brimstone. It turned first toward Dr. Baynard, but halted at the edge of the pentacle. Then its reddish, mad little eyes opened wider, and a hellish grin illumined its face. By that time the room was almost emptied, except for the doctor, now completely collapsed, within his chalk-drawn zone of safety. One or two of the ladies, more curious or less agile than the rest, saw, in a quick glance over her shoulder, a horrifying view of the demon as it seized delightedly upon Emily Parkinson. With its thick legs clamped about her neck, its claw-like paws tangled in her yellow hair, its heavy, hairless tail lashing her across the flanks, the thing rode Mrs. Parkinson as a rodeo performer rides a bucking horse, rode her around and around the platform, and then off through the air and out the skylight into the night. Her shrill, neighing screams died in the distance.